Nous en venons au troisième exposé de cet atelier par Valentine Gröbner qui parlera en anglais. Il m'a promis qu'il ne parlerait cet anglais ni avec son accent viennois d'origine, ni avec l'accent du fils alémanique qu'il a entre-temps pris lors de sa carrière dans une université suisse. Je le plaisante naturellement. Mais merci beaucoup, Valentine, de te prêter à cet exercice. Et donc, je te cède la parole.
Merci beaucoup. Peut-être on change de place. Je voudrais d'abord remercier pour la possibilité de présenter un peu de mes travaux ici et de le faire en anglais. Talking about individuality or the individual 600 years ago or now evokes a paradox inherent in communalité as an institution. Political communes and communities draw their legitimacy from the collective values they embody, but they themselves are formless, faceless. They need a body, a personification. But who exactly is it who gives the common goals, the common good, a voice, a biography, a face? The commune comme volonté collective stands in a paradoxic relations to the individuals who embodies it, who embody it. Some of you might remember the figure of the anonymous subcomandante Marcos, who gave, as ironic, iconic as he could, the Zapatista protest movement for defending the collective values of the Chiapas peasant communities in 1993, who tried to give the movement a face, but without a name, which in the end didn't work out too well. But the man was lecturer in sociology in a former life, and this is not a chance, not by chance. This very paradox is inherent in the expérience communale and in the rise of the urban communities in the later Middle Ages. As we have heard in the German-speaking realm, as in Italy and Flanders, self-governed cities were, from the 13th century on, politically and economically on the rise. In spite of military defeats, the most powerful of them, Nuremberg, Ulm, Strasbourg, Augsburg, Bern, Zurich, could expand their territories and win military conflicts against competing local nobles and princes in the 15th centuries. Ruled by patrician families or guilds, or by a combination of both, all these cities proudly declared themselves Gemein, communities of free citizens. In reality, political participation in these city republics was strictly limited. They were governed by a small elite of 20 to 40 families that delegated their members into the all-powerful Kleiner Rat, the governing council. Yet, as Olivier Richard has just beautifully explained, the ritual assembly of the Schwörtag, the community of all citizens, gathering on a public place and swearing solemnly the oath to obey the city laws and the city's officials as well, was the central political ritual of these communities. These were the communities the 19th century sociologist Ferdinand Tönnies had in mind when he compared influentially such traditional, warm, personal, but all-encompassing Gemeinschaften to the allegedly anonymous, functional and cold modern societies of the industrial age. The commune des sociologues, Florence Hulac has just presented to us. The medieval communes have served as historical models, ideals, and mythical origins to a wide array of political concepts. Patrick Boucheron has mentioned this in the last two centuries, from the radical socialists of the 1830s to the liberals of the 1840s and 1850s to the populists of the extreme right of the 1990s, Umberto Bossi's Lega movement evoking the glory of these medieval city communes, city republics, to be revived in a self-proclaimed separate North Italian state named Padania in the very same year as the Zapatista movement came out of the jungle in 1949, which, again, didn't work out too well. I think this retroactivation or post-production of the medieval urban communes is, if we like it or not, the very basis of our own scholarly work on it. We owe them most of our edited sources, and I mean this literally. It is the political instrumentalization of the medieval communes in the 19th century that sparked in Germany the huge enterprises of editing, well, collecting, reconstructing, and editing the surviving documents, records, and chronicles. The imposing series of the Chroniken der deutschen Städte started in 1862 by the Bayerische Akademie der Wissenschaften, published in the next 60 years, nearly 40 volumes and roughly 20,000 pages. And the first director was Karl Hegel, the son of the philosopher. Medieval history at the end of the 19th century strived as hard as possible to provide political models, blueprints. It desperately wanted to be Gesinnungspolitik, as Karl Hegel put it, a policy of ethos. The same goes for the most influential narrative about the communes in the 14th and 15th century, published 2 years earlier, Pierre Monet, On a déjà parlé, Jakob Burckhardt, Jakob Burckhardt's Kultur der Renaissance. In the Middle Ages, Burckhardt wrote, man was conscious of himself only as a member of, I quote, a race, people, party, family, or corporation, dreaming or half awake under a common veil. It was only at the turn of the 15th century, Burckhardt's famous phrase goes on, that this veil is blown aside, and I quote, the subjective side asserted itself with corresponding emphasis. Man became a spiritual individual and recognized himself as such, end of quote. And not just anywhere, but in the public realm of the city, on the piazza, as it were, of the 15th century city-states. In this 20th century, generations of historians have elaborated this motive, the birth of civic humanism, as Hans Baron has famously labeled it, he himself being a refugee from the Nazis in 1940, making this the very cornerstone of modern democracy and individualism, assuring a lasting presence of this Ursprungserzählung in encyclopedias and undergrad textbooks to this day. In a country like Switzerland, where I live, this maneuver, that is, the retrospective extension of democracy back to the city communes of the 14th and 15th centuries, is treated as a self-evident historical truth. We, our values, our democratic self-determination, and our unmistakable individuality, of course. They were already there 500, 600, 700 years ago. Seen from this perspective, it is of course highly significant that the first autobiography written in the German-speaking realm was composed by a citizen, the Augsburg chronicler Burckhard Zink, edited in one of the first volumes of Karl Hegel's Chroniken der deutschen Städte. Writing a history of his native Augsburg, he added, as book 4 of 5 in all, a highly personal record of his own provenance and career, being the first author in Germany using the first person singular, the magic little word, ich, moi. The very things with which we can so wonderfully make self-evident doing the history of the urban communities in the 14th and 15th century, that they are our origins, our value, our individuality, turn in practice, that is, when we get to the medieval texts and sources, very quickly into obstacles or traps. The families and clans governing these urban communities did not follow democratic procedures. Political participation was not for all, but only for a small and highly segregated clubs of wealthy Christian businessmen, bankers, and landlords. Politics in a city of the 15th century meant, above all, secrecy. All city councillors and officials had to swear an oath not to pass on, under menace of the harshest punishments, any information about what was discussed in the city's councils and meetings. Malpractice and abuse of office were the rule. The corruption of the city's judges and officials was proverbial. Separation between private and public matters was not existing. A high percentage of public communal records were preserved in private family archives, not in the regularly purged and revised official documents. Moreover, urban city dwellers did not define and describe themselves as individuals, but as members of corporations, families, and clienteles, as persons in groups, to whom, to the groups, they owed their social roles and their agencies. In order to be somebody in an urban environment, you needed friends, peers, colleagues, and most of all, powerful patrons and protectors. Patronage networks dominated every aspect of city lives, from politics to economics and marriage alliances, not only in Florence and Venice, where this is well studied, but also from Zurich to Nuremberg and Strasbourg. Few things, the American historian William Connell has remarked in his impressive book about Renaissance individualism, very few things would have evoked such terror in a 15th century citizen than the Burckhardt idea of living the life of an autonomous, self-sufficient individual that is alone. The urban communities in the Middle Ages were dominated by those who became, in the name of the Gemeinnutz, the common good, and the community, that were more influential than their fellow citizens, more ambitious, more powerful. The history of the German city republic is, among other things, the history of the big man who climbed in these communes to the height of civic power and dominance, often for periods of 10, 15, 20 years, followed by sudden downfall and spectacular execution for malpractice and corruption. In the two decades after 1430, for example, the merchant Peter Egen became Augsburg's richest and most powerful citizen, holding the highest communal offices, before accused of high treason and corruption. He had to flee the city overnight, never to return, all his possessions inside the city walls confiscated. 20 years later, the Augsburg guildmaster Ulrich Schwarz came to dominate civic politics, ruling Augsburg like a tyrant, his enemies declared, enemies who overturned him in 1478. He was executed for accepting bribes, violating the city laws, and conspiring with the city's enemies. The gallows for Schwarz was erected on the Augsburg main square, where the Schwurtag would take place, directly in front of the Trinkstuben, the meeting places of the Augsburg patrician families, whose power he had challenged, and who gathered in the windows to see their foe hung. So crowded were the roofs and windows with joyous onlookers, a chronicler noted, that some of them nearly fell down themselves. While Ulrich Schwarz landed on the gallows, his Zurich colleague Hans Waldmann began his steep political career as a powerful burgomaster of the Swiss city-state And this is a contemporary drawing of an eyewitness of his end, his public execution on the scaffold in 1489 for extortion, corruption, and high treason. These are not isolated cases, but they form a larger series. In Nuremberg, the mayor, Niklas Muffel, holding the highest office in the city, was executed in 1469. A year later, the same happened to the Schultheiss of Bern. 3 years after the fall of Waldmann, Schaffhausen hanged Konrad Hegenzi, head of the city's finance. 1509, the mayor, the Bürgermeister of Erfurt, Heinrich Keller, was executed. Regensburg decapitated its powerful councillor Liskirchner in 1513. Nuremberg jailing his long-serving patrician mayor Anton Tetzel for life in 1514. Augsburg hanging another Zunftmeister Jörg Ulmer in 1520. Accusations of secret conspiracies in the highest circles against the vital interests of the commune, the jailing, torture, trial, and the public confession of unspeakable crimes, all this was integral part of the city's political fabric and of the expérience communale at the turn of the 15th and the beginning of the 16th century. In all these cases, the contemporary commentators and chroniclers are somewhat vague and discordant what had brought the downfall of these powerful men. Ulrich Schwarz himself had, in 1477, an influential political adversary, the councillor Hans Wittel, executed for high treason and for violating the oath. Less than a year later, Schwarz selber hung at the gallows for harming the common good, extorting bribes and gifts. Schwarz, a chronicler notes, had planned to have all his enemies murdered in their houses together with their families and deliver the whole city to the arch enemy, the Bishop of Augsburg. When Zurich's strongman Hans Waldmann was overthrown 11 years later, the accusations and official explanations were practically identical. Waldmann had allegedly handed over the keys of the city to the emperor. He had accepted bribes and attempted to rape the wives and daughters of honorable Zurich councillors, plus committing unspeakable sodomitical acts as the protector of the Strasbourg knight Puller von Hohenburg, whose image of swearing the oath to the city Olivier Richard has shown us, and who was burned at the stake for having sexual relationships with men in Zurich several years later. Equally colorful and contradictory are the justifications of the downfalls of the other cases I've mentioned of Hegenzi, Kellner, and Tetzel. It is theft from the city's coffers, corruptions, selling out the city's secrets to its enemies. When armed Erfurt citizens in 1509 stormed the town hall to overthrow the powerful Bürgermeister Heinrich Kellner, Kellner sprang up and yelled, "All hier steht die Gemeinde," here is where the commune stands, pointing to his own chest, only to be executed. Tortured and executed 4 months later. Embodying the commune as volonté générale can be risky. It is not that similar stories of steep ascent to power followed by sudden downfall were unknown in the princely courts of the late 15th century, but what makes the urban cases so particular is the motive of the alienated or corrupted common good of the city. In some of these cases, surviving detailed sources and interrogation records allow close insights into the political fabric of the cities with intricate networks of loyalty and hate between different guilds, parties, and families. Functioning systems of patronage and social bindings leave practically no written traces as long as they work. Only the scandal, the sudden breaking up of the informal consensus, produces the detailed records we can, 500 years later, use for reconstructing the workings of these liaisons and clientèles. The ambitious Augsburg chronicler and self-made man Burkhard Zink, the first to use ich, the first person singular, in his autobiography, notes meticulously the loans he had been given from the powerful Peter Egen. Zink carefully adds that he had not been the only one to follow Peter Egen as a patron and protector. Many others had done the same, he asserts us. Egen, he wrote, had been such a good-looking, handsome man, ein hübscher, wohlgestalter Mann, in German, und gar grausam freundlich gegen arm Leut, cruelly friendly to the poor. Peter Egen, Augsburg's richest and most powerful man in the first half of the 15th century, had been elected head of the city 8 times in a row. Egen had been the face, the embodiment of the proud city republic, ein hübscher, wohlgestalter Mann. Is such a formulaic description of Egen's good looks a proof of the notion of individuality, of the rise of the individual in the city republics in the 15th century? No portraits of Peter Egen have survived, neither of his successor, Ulrich Schwarz, executed 20 years later. But Schwarz, as his unhappy Nuremberg colleague Niklas Muffel, executed 9 years earlier, 1469, had left quite long autobiographical accounts, written in the first person singular, but with no hints to the intense political infighting they were actually part of. Description of Schwarz from contemporary chroniclers, all hostile against the Bürgermeister and written after his downfall, yet highlight a particular individual aspect, namely his luxurious clothes. Augsburg's rigid sumptuary laws prohibited the wearing of pearls, gilded textiles, velvet, and bright silks. But because of his stylish outfit, Schwarz's enemies nicknamed him the Schwarzrapp, a big eye-catching bird, stork-like, an ibis, a variation of the ibis, who is today extinct in Europe, with conspicuous feathers shining in black and green and a big bald head. This is what Ulrich Schwarz must have looked like. When he entered the scaffold, a chronicler writes, he wore a coat of velvet, a head adorned with pearls, and a silk coat. He handed over his costume to the hangman, who, after the execution, had swaggered around in the city proudly wearing the dead Bürgermeister's posh get-up, as he himself were Schwarz, a chronicler needed, until the city, for a substantial sum of money, bought the clothes back from the hangman. The executed man's conspicuous individual costume could, it seems, not only challenge the re-established communal order, but embody the hanged man himself. Notions of communality, of the political experience of the city republic and individuality in the 15th and 16th century could thus spring up at surprising instances in discourses about corruption and secrecy, in rumors and allegations about loans and dependencies, in narrative about good-looking or too good-looking men on the scaffolds and their wardrobes and bald birds. No mention of all this in the retelling and in the mythologization of the glorious medieval city republic in the German and Swiss historiography and sociology of the 19th and early 20th century. Our values, our roots, our democratic self-determination, and our unmistakable individuality have, of course, no place for spectacular cases of misuse of power and corruption. With one exception, maybe. In the first decades of the 20th century, conservative circles in Zurich demanded the political rehabilitation of the executed Bürgermeister Hans Waldmann. Hans Waldmann, they held, was a hero of the Swiss people and a great military and civic leader, and from 1932 on, they started systematic campaigning and collecting donations for a memorial dedicated to Waldmann. The Bürgermeister executed 450 years ago, the right-wing Nationale Front declared, the idea of a strong Führerperson urgently needed in contemporary Switzerland. After vitriolic public debate in 1932, 1837, a granite statue of Waldmann was finally erected, immediately becoming the target of attacks from radical socialist and communist activists. And then, with the disintegration of the Swiss Fascist Party after 1937, smoothly gliding back into, where? Oblivion. The statue still stands. But the attempt to confer the communal value a face and the heroic body of an Arterian strongman from the 15th century was countered with the secret weapon available to all political communities when confronted with an inappropriate aspect of their own past, ignoring them, blinking them away, forgetting them, the very fate Subcommandante Marcos so desperately wanted for himself. Thank you.
Un très grand merci, cher Valentine, d'abord pour cette clarté d'exposition en anglais qui augmente considérablement votre croyance sur votre propre niveau présumé de langue. Mais plus sérieusement, un grand merci pour avoir abordé au fond la face cachée de l'expérience communale, secret, corruption, patronage, népotisme, calomnie, tentative d'exercice personnel, solitaire du pouvoir, procès politique, exécution. Au fond, tout ce que contient l'autre fresque de Sienne, pour faire allusion naturellement au beau livre de Patrick Boucheron, Conjurer la peur. Hein. On parle toujours des fresques du bon gouvernement, mais il y a aussi celle du mauvais gouvernement. Et je crois que nos réflexions sur la Commune ne doivent pas oublier cette représentation et cette appréhension des propres contemporains qui vivent dans les communes de la préservation, au fond, de l'expérience dans ses origines et que ça ne soit pas dénaturé, au fond. Dans cette confrontation, et Valentine, tu en as fait allusion, tu y as fait allusion, pardon, dans cette confrontation, dans cette collision toujours possible, au fond, entre l'intérêt collectif du groupe, de la commune, et la tentation, la tentative inhérente de l'intérêt personnel. Et au fond, naturellement, l'historien doit évidemment tenir compte de cette collision permanente à la rencontre de laquelle se situe au fond peut-être une définition de la personne, qui est peut-être une notion plus médiévale que celle d'individu, personne au sens du rôle du théâtre, du masque. Hein, et donc l'identité personnelle se situant toujours à la confrontation, à la rencontre, entre l'adhésion à un ensemble de valeurs collectives par lesquelles tu as commencé, à juste titre, et la personnalisation, l'individualisation d'un certain nombre de marqueurs personnels, familiaux, etc. Bien. Donc, pour tout cela, un très très grand merci. Y a-t-il d'abord des questions ponctuelles sur l'exposé qui vous a été présenté? Oui, s'il vous plaît.